Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And welcome to Caged In Presents Copeland Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. If you're new to this here podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? You join us for episode 61, and the film under the microscope this week is Michael Bay's 2001 war drama, Pearl Harbor. And joining me for this chat is Alice Boyd Leslie, but more on her shortly. As ever with this podcast, we will be spoiling this film. So if you haven't seen it, I believe you can head on over to Disney Plus right now and watch it at your leisure. I'm not sure where that translates elsewhere. Maybe Hulu, maybe Disney Plus. Don't know what it's like in the States. I don't know what the license agreements are, but it's a pretty easy film to find. So yeah, we'll be spoiling everything about this film. And this one is a lot of fun. We get into porn parodies. We get into alternate versions of this film. And we get into the real love story of it. And it was an absolute blast to have this chat with Alice. But be sure to stick around for the end where we get a nice little spicy take from Alice about the big daddy himself, Francis Ford Coppola. This one is a lot of fun. With all of that out of the way, all that's left to do is to cuckold your best mate. Really underserve one of your only real historical characters and blow shit up in only a way that Michael Bay can as we make some Copa connections with Pearl Harbor. We're taken to the skies this week as we look at the 2001 war drama Pearl Harbor, directed by Michael Bay and written by Randall Wallace. The film stars Ben Affleck, Josh Hartnett, Kate Beckinsale, Cuba Gooding Jr., Tom Sizemore and John Voight. So if I'm jumping into a plane this week and heading into battle, I feel like I'm going to need somebody to be watching my wings. So to help me decide if this film is a triumph or a misfire, and to see if it proves that the Coppolas are the greatest film family of all time, somebody's used to horror movies instead of the horrors of war. It's one third of the Drunken Horror Podcast, Alice Boyd Leslie. How are you, Alice?
Oh, that was beautiful. Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. Excited to jump on my plane.
Yeah, after a three-hour long movie, do you feel like you have gone through war? Not to besmirch, obviously, people who go through such horrific events, but how are you feeling after the 3 hours of Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor?
I definitely feel like I went through a war a little bit. It was It was very long. Needlessly, I might say, in some cases.
Oh, yeah. We'll get into that. Yeah, definitely. I will assure you guys listening at home that this podcast will be as brief as we can make it, because we don't want to then obviously talk about the ridiculous length of this movie and then talk the same amount on this film, because there's not even that much to fill 3 hours of a movie, so there wouldn't be enough to fill, I don't know, well, the sexual tension between Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett, I think I could talk for three hours, but we'll get to that. Before we get going, obviously, I mentioned you host the Drunken Horror podcast. Tell the listeners what that podcast is. What do you guys do over there?
So we basically have a movie to discuss each episode. We sometimes have a guest on, sometimes just us three, and we have a drink of choice each, and then we just chat about the movie, very similar to what you do, really. And we try to fit a drink kind of themed around the movie that we've chosen, but sometimes that doesn't work, and sometimes life just gets in the way and you can't be clever, and so you're just like, I'll just grab a whatever I've got in the cupboard. But we want to keep it nice and chill and good vibes, and it's like when you're at the pub with mates and you're chatting about movies.
I did a series on this podcast last year to discuss The Offer, the TV series about the making of The Godfather, and we decided, me and my kind of co-host for that, we were like, we'll drink a themed bottle of wine every episode to kind of fit and try and like link it to the episode. So there was an episode, they go to Sicily. We were like, hey, let's have let's get a bottle of wine from Sicily. Or like we just did themed weeks. It's like sangria week, because I think we were recording during like the hottest summer we've ever had. So like, we've just got to have some sweet relief for ourselves. But yeah, I think boozing and podcasting can resort in some of the best podcasts ever, or some of the most tiresome in the fact that you're going to have to edit a lot out. How does that work for you guys? Does the booze add to more edit time, or is it kind of just free you guys up?
I do hardly any editing, really. I just basically take out if there's a bit too many ums, and then I just let the chaos just ensue.
Amazing.
It's hard not to let I'm the kind of the controller between the two, my two co-hosts. I just let them run free, and I try to just like put them back together. And there's been some episodes where some of us have gotten very drunk and it's quite noticeable near the end. And there's some where we've been a lot more well-behaved. So it's always interesting going back to the edit room seeing how drunk we got.
I think I've like recorded drunk, edited drunk, and like released it, and then kind of like never listened again as well. That sounds really bad. Like, I'm just always drunk. I just think I just all did it all in the same night. I was just like, let's get this out, like a little goblin. Yeah.
Definitely.
Wake up with the shame tomorrow once it's out there, and to Twitter ablaze. My Twitter mentions ablaze with people going like, did you mean to say that on the podcast? you just went off talking about something unrelated to to leaving Las Vegas. What a day.
It's fine. It's all good.
So obviously you're here, to talk about a Coppola Connections movie. And one of the questions we always ask at the beginning of this is, when did you become aware of the Coppola family? So was there like an entry point, like person? But then when did you kind of figure out there's kind of like this sprawling network of family members who have kind of got their fingers in all of the cinematic pies they possibly can?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably, so I studied film at college and at university. So it was probably around then. I was probably about 16 when I watched my first Coppola film. And then it was kind of from then, like I've studied some Coppola movies, or an essays about them, and the same with Sofia Coppola as well. But I didn't realize how massive the family tree is until you sent it to me. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, it's crazy. It started from a kind of mid-teens, really.
Yeah, and obviously like the Coppola connection for this film is John Schwartzman, who I guess some people could think is tenuous because he is Jason and Robert Schwartzman's half-brother, like from a marriage previous to Talia Shire. So, but Nicolas Cage once said in an interview, like, he referred to him as my cousin because he was the cinematographer on The Rock. So I'm like, I'm taking that. He's probably been invited to Christmas dinners. Like, he's definitely a part of the clan, right?
100%, yeah. Okay.
So what films have you written these essays on? Like, I'd be interested. And like, what kind of subject matters were you kind of looking into?
Oh, well, I have to dig the memory bank a little bit for what subject matters. But I remember having to write an essay on The Conversation. Oh, and that was, I really didn't like that film. So that was very difficult. I mean, I haven't seen it since I had to watch it like two or three times to write this essay at uni, I think. So maybe like now in my 30s, I might enjoy it. But I really didn't like it when I first saw it.
I always think, I'm not sure if you're a fan of Brian De Palma's Blowout, but that's kind of like the more like, I don't know, sleazy version of The Conversation. It's like, let's kind of do it, but like, let's throw in this kind of thriller, like almost like sub horror plot of like a murderer as well, as opposed to just like this brooding tension of a man who like once killed somebody on a job or like let somebody die and like kind of his mind unraveling. I get it.
Yeah, definitely. And then The Virgin Suicides as well. I think I was probably at college or something when I had to do something with that. Again, I can't remember because it's, you know, a very, very long time ago now, unfortunately. but yeah, and then I've seen The Godfather and all of that, and Apocalypse Now. I think I must have watched Apocalypse Now during GCSE because I studied the Vietnam War and we watched Platoon. And then I was like, I want to watch other like Vietnam based movies. Amazing. And then I watched Apocalypse Now and I was like, what the heck is this?
Yeah, kind of more just like a meditation on madness than it is. I guess that plays into the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I always love, there's a quote from Francis Ford Coppola at Cannes when he was like premiering that film. And it's like, this film isn't about Vietnam. This film is Vietnam. We went into the jungle, too much money, too many of us. And we lost our minds as we went on. I was like, the guy fucking went. He went method directed on a movie. I love it. so yeah. I guess it captures Vietnam in spirit, right? As opposed to like portraying what it might have actually been like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Amazing. So you've written about the Coplas. Have you ever met a Coppola? We never know. There's so many of them. I always have to ask my guests if they've ever met one.
I wish I had, but no, I haven't. I've met very boring celebrities. So
I'm sure they're not boring to someone. There's always
well, yeah, there. Exactly. But yeah, no, I've never met one. Maybe one day, maybe Drunken Horror will lead me to meeting a Coppola somehow.
There we go. Yeah, that's the dream. That's the dream. Like, I don't know. Yeah, like, I think the best answer I've ever had for that as well is somebody said, well, I saw Phantom Planet once when Jason Schwartzman was the drummer. I was like, yeah, I'm having it. You breathed air. You breathed his sweaty drummer air. Yes, please. Yeah.
What a throwback as well.
Co-writer of the absolute banger California as well. So
yeah, exactly.
Not only is he kind of dining out on Wes Anderson money, he's dining out on the royalties every time the OC gets replayed.
Yeah. Amazing. What a life.
So obviously, yeah, John Schwartzman is a weird one because his name probably won't be bannered around on a film. But what would have been the first, yeah, John Schwartzman film you would have potentially have seen, Alice?
It was almost definitely Armageddon, I think. I watched that film so much when I was younger. And this movie reminded me so much of Armageddon, which I'm sure we'll get into. There are just so many similarities in how it's shot and certain moments as well. I'm like, this is just Armageddon, but on Earth. Like, what is going on?
I won't say which is which, but like, I will say about Armageddon and this film being very similar. There's one of them that I love, and there's one of them that I do not love.
Okay.
Amazing. Yeah, Armageddon. What an interesting film. And obviously the first time that Ben Affleck worked with Michael Bay.
For
the longest time, because this was my first time watching Pearl Harbor as well. As yourself, you'd said to me like off air, like this is the first time you've ever watched this film. I for the longest time just assumed that it was Liv Tyler in the Kate Beckinsale role.
Yes. I was saying the exact same thing to my partner as well. I was like, there's so many similarities. I was like, even Evelyn looks like Liv Tyler. What's going on?
Amazing. Well, yeah, let's jump in and talk about Pearl Harbor.
How long is America going to pretend the world is not at war? From Berlin, Rome, and Tokyo, we have been described as a nation of weaklings and playboys who hire British or Russian or Chinese soldiers to do our fighting for us.
I'm going to the war.
You just make sure and come back for the both of us, all right?
We've been trained to think that we're invincible. But our people think Hitler and his Nazi thugs are Europe's problem. Does anyone think that victory is possible without facing danger?
Warning of Japanese aggressive movement.
December 7th. 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
So this film was made on a budget of $140 million and made a box office return of $450.2 million. It was released on May 21st in Pearl Harbor, must I stress, before a wide release statewide on the 25th of May 2001. The film was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, one of which it won, and it was nominated for 6 Golden Raspberries. And fortunately for Michael Bay and company, it lost all of its categories. So, Alice, could you do us the pleasure of telling us what Pearl Harbor is all about?
Well, you might not have guessed from the title of the film. It's set during World War II and follows the story of 2 lifelong best friends, Rafe and Danny, they're played by Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett, and they both become Army Air Corps pilots. And Rafe meets a Navy nurse called Evelyn, not played by Liv Tyler, and they have a sudden whirlwind romance and fall in love almost instantly. Soon after that, Rafe is asks and accepts to go to England to help fight the war. And which results in him getting gunned down and presumed dead. Go all the way back to the US, and the aftermath of Rafe's death leads Danny and Evelyn to find comfort in each other and eventually start a relationship, resulting in Evelyn to fall pregnant. Then Rafe comes back from the dead. They have a little fight with Danny, and then Pearl Harbor happens. Loads of Michael Bay explosions. And from the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, Rafe and Danny are sent on a top secret mission to get revenge on the Japanese which ultimately results in Danny dying, saving Rafe. And then Rafe and Evelyn live happily ever after and predictably call Evelyn's child Danny.
Yes, it is a smorgasbord of, I think one of the films to blame for this, and I'm not sure if you agree with me here, is Titanic. I think Titanic's got a lot to answer for this movie. What do you think of that?
I never thought of that, but yes, 100%.
It's 100%. It's the Titanification, and I'm coining that word right now, of kind of a historical event, because they obviously, Michael Bay would have sat down and gone, do you know what's really great about Titanic? Is it's got this horrific thing that happened in history, but we just follow this whirlwind romance. Like, what can be better than that? A kind of weird throuple where one of them thinks that the other is dead, and in the comfort of kind of grieving partner / and best friend, they find love, and he's not dead after all. And then we get to the key event of the titular moment of this film, and there's an hour or so left of the movie.
It's ridiculous. I think we paused it just after like Pearl Harbor happened, and there was all the kind of like funeral stuff, just to go and get some snacks or something. And I was like, there is still 50 minutes left. I was like, what else can happen? I feel like it's ended about three times.
it's got that Return of the King thing, hasn't it? Of like, it's time to get out of your seat. Oh, no, it's definitely not. Like, So what were kind of like your, let's kind of go back. I want to know, obviously this film came out in 2001. Who were you in 2001 to not have seen this? Like why do you think at the time you might not have seen this film, Alice?
Yeah, I am actually so surprised that I never saw this film back in its day, because this is the kind of movie that I would have 100% watched with my dad. Because we watch these kinds of action films. And I have no idea why it took until now to watch it. Like, I can't even answer that question for you, because it's like, it's one of those films that I would have probably watched time and time again back in 2001.
And it's the kind of film as well that I imagine, like, well, yeah, I know for certain would have had hard rotation on like one of the ITV channels.
Right? Like, always on ITV2. Well, yeah, definitely.
When Googling this film last night, again, it kind of like Google gives you like when the listings are on TV. And it's like, this film was like multiple listings on TV. And I was like, that's crazy. Because obviously that's for like the next week or so. I was like, this is just always on, I'm guessing. Like,
yeah. I can't believe it. Like, it took me so long to watch it. I'm kind of glad that I did.
What's your kind of relationship with Michael Bay? Because I'm kind of like this, I go in and out of love with him. Like, do you know what I mean? There's certain stuff of his where I'm like, oh, he is the devil. Do you know what I mean? He's this misogynist, jingoistic asshole. And then he releases a film like, cue the siren here, because I've mentioned this so many times on this podcast. Releases Ambulance, and I absolutely adore that film and what he did with it. It's kind of like, and I think this film, and it's interesting because obviously the James Cameron kind of like mirroring, I always look at Michael Bay as the kind of Wario to James Cameron's Mario. And like, I think this film is like the ultimate kind of like justification of that statement, right? Of like, it's kind of like, I'm gonna take what you do and then do it all wrong. I'm gonna like kind of like pay no respect to the people who are harmed in this and just kind of like go all guns blazing.
Michael Bay, he makes some questionable movies, but then also they are good, like, you know, quote unquote popcorn movies, and they're good things to just like watch with your family most of the time. They're good for the whole family, like with Pearl Harbor, the whole family is gonna love this. Like, your mom's gonna love it because there's a romance in it, your dad's gonna love it because there's explosions. Like, it's like, if we're being stereotypical here on what, you know,
your nan's love. Gonna love it because there's some racism. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, all generations are gonna love it. There's like your little brother's got like there's a goofy one, do you know what I mean, who can't propose, like you and Bremner stumbling, bumbling all over the place. I think that is Michael Bay is like old school four quadrant cinema. Do you know what I mean? Like now it's I guess this would have been the 90s equivalent of like superhero movies, right? It's just these kind of like big action movies that what is this, like a 12 in the UK? So like a PG-13 in the US. So anyone can really watch it. So what were your kind of initial thoughts watching this film?
I mean, I thought it was fine. it's like we've said, it went on for far too long. There's so much that could have got missed out, or cut out. But I don't think I'll ever watch it again, but I think I did quite enjoy it. I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd. So, like, you know, it's not the greatest film ever by any means, but, you know, it's like I said, it's a fun, you just want to have something on that you can just laugh at how ridiculous it is and eat a bunch of popcorn. And like maybe go on your phone a little bit. And you probably haven't missed a whole bunch, and just have something on in the background. And I think it's perfect for that. It was probably really great to see in the cinema in like the early 2000s. I can imagine.
Yeah, and I feel like I don't know. Like I probably watched this in the worst conditions. Michael Bay would probably be like, I don't know, wringing his hands at the way I watched this. So I watched this in like multiple sittings. Like kind of partly on my TV, partly on my phone.
Yeah.
Partly on like my like a tiny little TV I have that I use as a second screen where I'm recording the podcast. So like it's kind of like, yeah, I watched it in chunks. I think I passed them out in like good little chunks. It's kind of like, Danny's gone off to England. Have a little break. Rafe's gone off to England. Have a little break.
Yeah.
Get up to the end of Pearl Harbor. Have a little break and then kind of watch the rest. So like, you know, kind of like 3 hour chunks or like,
I think it's a good way to do it like that as well. Like, I think it's one of those films that you can pause and come back to. I very nearly did the same. I watched it last night and I started watching it at about 8:30. And then it got to like 11 and I was like, oh, it's like already past my bedtime. Like, there's still so much left to go. Like, should I watch the rest tomorrow? But I didn't, and I stuck through it. But yeah, it's one of those films that you can totally do in bits. And I'm not judging you for watching it on your phone or anything, because sometimes I do the same as well.
I think the worst part about it is I at one point was watching it, you know, because it's on Disney Plus, so I could watch it whilst being on other apps. It just kind of does like a little pop up on the thingy. So I was like kind of scrolling through Twitter, replying to some stuff, or like doing the tweet where I was like, hey, we're watching this tonight and I've got Pearl Harbor. If I'd screenshotted my screen at the moment, it's like I'm tweeting, asking what people's thoughts are about the film, and I'm watching the film in the tiniest little like box ever. And it was, it was fine.
I love that though. Like, I'm so happy for that little pop-up screen because it just makes my life so much easier.
When apps don't offer it, I'm like, you fucking charlatan. It's like, what are you doing?
How dare you? I need to be on Twitter constantly.
So what, where do you want to kind of like dive into this film? Because there is some kind of, as much as we said, it is kind of popcorn fluff and fun. Obviously, it's a very serious topic for the film. Obviously, it's a massive tragedy, but then there are weird things to kind of delve into here. And I don't know. I'll throw this out. Should we start with the relationship stuff? Because I feel like that is, the film thinks that's important.
Yeah.
How do you feel? Do you feel like the relationship stuff's important? I'm kind of, I don't know. I've got a theory of how we could make this film better, but I'll let you go first.
Okay. Let me go first. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it's not. I think if you're going to make a movie called Pearl Harbor, it's got to be predominantly about Pearl Harbor, right? And it's not at all. It's just kind of shoehorned in to create this love story. kind of. And yeah, I mean, it's, I feel like I got quite attached to the, actually the only love story that I got really attached to and I got really upset about was Red and Betty's relationship. I was like, I know that like one of them is going to die and it's going to break my heart. And I like, and you know, with Betty dying, I did actually like start to well up a bit. I was like, why are the others surviving? Like, I don't care about them. Like, I was want Red and Betty to get married and have like 10,000 children and just live their best lives. Like, and we had to deal with, you know, Ben Affleck, and it was just so predictable as well. I think that like we got like an hour in and I was like, right, so like when Danny and Evelyn started getting together, I was like, well, this isn't going to end up right, is it? Like, you know, Rafe comes back and then Danny saves Rafe and then they call the kid Danny at the end and then that was what happens, and he was like, oh well, there you go. Like, of course.
when did you call that she was pregnant as well? Because I think like there's a moment and they really like the writing on it and the acting as well. It's like, what are you doing in there, Evelyn? You've been in the toilet for ages. And it's like, really? Are we doing this? Like, yeah. She might as well just be coming out and going like wiping vomit off of her face. Like come on. That moment, I kind of like put down my nose. She's pregnant, right? Like,
yeah. That was exactly it. And her walking out just like, you know, hand over the mouth. And he was like, oh, okay. So she's pregnant. And then this is what's going to happen. Like, and, you know, it did. It's fine.
Well, yeah, obviously Rafe essentially gets cucked, right? That's the kind of like, that's the that's the crux of it. And then he gets uncucked because his friend gets killed. Like, what a kind of, I since watching the film, I just keep thinking about the kind of, I don't know, the how weird all of that is. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know, like, yeah, like it just feels really, I don't know, like, I think, and yeah, it's kind of, this is a point I'd been thinking about in the film, I think, because unintentionally, just because obviously the camera, Michael Bay, and obviously the way that, yeah, like John Schwartzman is shooting stuff between Danny and Rafe, I'm like, there's like a frisson of something between them. It kind of shoots them in a like a romantic way. Do you know what I mean? Like when they're kind of arguing and sparring. What I think would have been a far more interesting way of telling this story. And net like no way on the budget this film was made for would it have been done was them two being a gay couple. And then the same stuff happens. Rafe goes off. But just to like conform to the time and like what the kind of norms were for then, like Danny gets in this relationship with Evelyn. And then you've still got the same like kind of like tension. He gets her pregnant, but then you've got like the same tension coming back, but it's the tension is more so like Rafe is annoyed with Evelyn. Like, you stole my man, like kind of thing. And then, like, the ultimate, like, I don't know, it'd be like a real, like, darker ending at the fact that, like, Rafe's gay lover is killed in battle. So he decides to push down his own, like, homosexuality to raise this child. Like I think that makes this, like, a more meatier film and, like, kind of, like,
definitely
more ballsy, right?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking like, is it gonna go that way? Like, because there's some bits where you're like, there's something going on here. Is this gonna get a bit Brokeback Mountain on us? But I would never expect Michael Bay to go about that movie. He's far too hetero to even think about that.
Yeah,
to happen.
He's all testosterone explosions, but. Like, Jimmy, he's got Tom Sizemore in there, just to kind of like there's not enough testosterone in this film. It's like, my fucking action is the juice. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's get Tom Sizemore, a fucking maniac in this as well.
Exactly. I mean, that sounds like it would be wonderful, but maybe in like Pearl Harbor 2 or something like that, it would happen if there's ever a remake.
I
of this movie, which I hope there is never. but maybe there should be. I'm sure there is probably a dirty movie out there where that does happen.
I might have to Pearl Harbor porn parody. My Google search history is just about to get fucked, ladies and gentlemen.
It's got to be. I'd be so surprised if there isn't.
Oh, here we go. Oh, yes, there is Pearl Harbor porn. Yeah, it comes up.
Yeah.
I don't want to click on any of the links.
That's fair.
Because I feel like some of them might be racist as well. Do you know what I mean? Like,
there is that.
Yeah. You can imagine some like, oh, some horrific things said for interracial porn. I'm derailing this podcast and kind of giving into it.
Sorry, I'm bringing it down already.
I love it. on like a filmmaking standpoint, like, what do you think of the way that Michael Bay and like John Schwartzman shoot the kind of romantic scenes between the kind of the two different couples? Because obviously we have that sequence. I think it's like there's that sequence at the beginning when there's the burgeoning romance between Rafe and Evelyn, where they kind of go on this little date to like go up the side of a ship and stuff like that. And there's that shot where they kind of walking the streets and there's kind of like sparks, like literal sparks flying as if we're not, like, as if as an audience we're like, oh, here we fucking go. What do you think? And then there's the other sequence where Danny and Evelyn kind of go out in the plane and kind of like end up in the, what is it, parachute shed or something like that?
That's one thing, that was one similarity with Armageddon, is that there's always like there's the air hangar like sex scene that also kind of happens in Armageddon as well. So like I mean, it's interesting because like Danny and Evelyn's like scenes, they seem a little bit more romantic. Mm-hmm. I found, and I was a little bit more like, I can kind of believe their relationship a little bit as it was kind of going on. I felt a little bit with Rafe and Evelyn, it was just, this is just like they've known each other for 30 seconds and suddenly like they're in love with each other. And you know, with the sparks, literal sparks flying, which is also another thing that happens in Armageddon as well. I think they must just like have a little like cutout of like, this is how romance scene should look like.
That's built into a Michael Bay budget. It's like we've got a guy grinding an axe grinder on some metal at all times. Like, we've got to have that shot, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. And where's my grinder guy? He needs to get in here for this scene.
Oh no, that's for the Pearl Harbor remake, the grinder guy.
Oh yeah. We'll always link it back to porn somehow.
One of the things that I did like about the kind of romance stuff is that story that Evelyn tells of meeting Rafe. And I think what it does well is it captures that sometimes when you do kind of fancy someone, you act like an absolute idiot in the way that like Rafe does, where he's kind of like, he's got all this brash bravado, but then that's really broken down really quickly when he kind of like, he ends up fainting and like, or like, getting knocked out. And then that scene with the champagne bottle, which I think like is quite a tender and like funny moment in the film. And it's like, with that stuff, I was like, I don't know where this film is going to go. I have very strong suspicions, and it did go to all those places, but I was like, oh, this could be sweet. Like it could do the Titanic. It could have, at that point, it's like, this could go the full Titanic. Like, this could end with the events of Pearl Harbor and it'd be like quite a tragic ending. Whereas it kind of went, oh no, we can't end with that, because that's the Americans losing. We have to get to a point where it's like, we're fucking up the Japanese. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah. In like any kind of American war movie, and then like never in the wrong, and they saved us. And you know, all of that stuff. It just always makes me laugh in these kinds of movies.
What did you think of the portrayal of the British troops in this as well? When we get those brief scenes of Rafe in the UK, I guess it's probably filmed in like, I don't know, New England, like, do you know what I mean? somewhere a bit colder in the US.
Yeah, yeah,
the one location. I mean,
it was 100% stereotypical. Like, no surprises really from me. Sitting in a pub, drinking outside, and the old, you know, jolly old chap, and a good old like tap on the back, and you know, get on with it.
Yeah, he's just like an angry Scottish man as well.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Come on, Rafe, you got the do this. Like, all right, the ticking off those stairs. And like that whole kind of plot beat is basically a living embodiment of what you said about, like, it was the Americans who helped us. The British were so fucked. It's like, we had to ship in their best guys, like, to help us out.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, like, we probably would have done all right without you, but, you know, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just every kind of stereotype of everyone around the UK that they could kind of shoehorn in, which you just kind of get used to now with these kinds of movies. It's like, it's no surprise that we're going to have the, you know, the incredibly posh one, the Scot, like the Americans wouldn't be able to understand what the hell they're saying. But I guess it would be comical to them. But you know, yeah, this is all part of these kinds of movies, right? Like, it's just,
gristle for the mill, right? Of just like, yeah, it all just kind of like, I don't know. And I think where this, this is where I show my hand of how I feel about Armageddon. I think what Armageddon does right is it just gets like a load of amazing character actors to to inhabit that world. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you kind of break down the cast of that movie, like Owen Wilson, like a really interesting point in his career, do you know what I mean, had only made Bottle Rocket before then. And I love the story that Michael Bay saw Bottle Rocket, like a Wes Anderson movie, and went, He's gonna be an astronaut in my. He's gonna be a driller in my next movie. Like, it kind of makes me feel differently about Michael Bay. Like, okay, maybe he's got like some indie cred. And like Steve Buscemi, you've got even Bruce Willis. I know, obviously, like at that time he's a massive kind of marquee name. But then who else? Peter Stormare turns up in that. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, Ian Michael Duncan. Like, there's kind of like just a great kind of like roster of like great talent, like Bill Patton and stuff like that. Whereas like this feels, I don't know, what do you think of like the casting in this? Obviously, we do have like some familiar faces, like an earlier Michael Shannon role, and I mentioned Tom Sizemore. And I guess someone we really need to talk about in this conversation is Cuba Gooding Jr., who, like, I'm not sure about you, before I saw this film, I thought he was in it a lot more than he is.
I mean, I actually had no idea he was in it. But he plays like quite a big, in the terms of Pearl Harbor, he plays like a real life person that existed.
Yes.
And he just kind of gets like pushed to the side a little bit. And it's like, well, we'll kind of see what he did. Like that, you know, deserved his medal, but not really. And he deserved to have a little bit more if they were going to be like, yeah, this was the first African-American to win this medal at the end, to tell us that. And we're like, what did he do? I don't know. But it isn't until you like look up about it, you're like, oh, okay, so he did that, okay, cool, that makes sense.
Well, yeah, he was like, so we get what, maybe like two key scenes with him. We get him introduced for a boxing match, and then he ends up going to Evelyn. Like, yeah, Evelyn's kind of doing some work on him, right, at the hospital, and then that kind of goes straight into, it's almost like just kind of like, oh, we need, like, at that moment I was like, is this just a weird bridge into another scene between like Danny and, or is it like Rafe and Evelyn? I can't remember which one of the two it is. And then
I can't remember which way around it goes with that. But
and then we get the scene of him on the boat, and then it's like, that's all we see of him until the end of the film. And it's like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah, I kind of felt like we need to have someone who actually, you know, existed during Pearl Harbor, just so there's a little bit of, you know, real, oh, I say real history, it all obviously happened, but, you know, it's a kind of character that someone could be like, oh, okay, this person, okay, I know that person, I studied about that person at school or something like that. But just didn't really do it justice at all. It was just all so focused on this relationship. That's just all it felt like. It's just it's a romance film, and there's just like a little bit of war that's shoved in.
Yeah. And it kind of commits one of the, like, the cardinal sins of films, I think, of offering you a little slice of a film you could be watching. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think with the Cuba Gooding Jr. stuff, like, that's a really interesting film, like, of this kind of guy who I would imagine would have been looked down upon within the Navy and stuff like that, kind of, as we see, like, when he takes up the gun, like, on the ship and stuff like that, he doesn't look like he's even been trained to do that. He kind of, like, you get the impression, I'm not sure if he, like, works in, like, he's a cook, or do you know what I mean? He kind of, like,
yeah,
he's not one of, like, the top guys on, or do you know what I mean? Yeah, he's not one of the kind of go-to guys, and, like, he looks scared taking up that gun. And it's like, wouldn't that have been a great movie of just seeing that guy and, like, kind of being throughout the movie, like, either, yeah, like, on that boat a lot more, and kind of, like, how terrifying that would have been. Because, like, we only get so much time kind of with the boat stuff, where it's like, oh, no, we got to get back to Danny and Rafe sleeping in a car after they've kind of... Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
obviously, exactly. Obviously fucked after they made up.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and that's like, and one of the things with that whole, like, when Pearl Harbor actually happens, like, when I was kind of reading up about this film, reading about trivia, is that the whole hospital scene where the Japanese bombed the hospital, like, didn't actually happen. And, you know, that caused a lot of uproar with, like, veterans and people who knew about, I had studied Pearl Harbor and stuff, because it was, like, apparently, like, the Japanese were given strict orders to not bomb any civilians or attack any civilians. And Michael Bay just kind of did that just because he thought it would be, you know, a little bit better. And it was like... Mm-mm.
It's a way to, it's a way to give some jeopardy to Evelyn, and it obviously serves the story beat, because we don't, like, Betty doesn't die if that doesn't happen without getting kind of, like, caught in the shrapnel, or, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, kind of being in the blast radius of a bomb. And it's like, there is an element of stuff that happens and way things are handled of like racism within this film. I find like, as we said about the Cuba Gooding Jr. kind of, like, sidelining that real life character for focus on two fictional characters feels massively racist. And then kind of, like, the portrayal of the Japanese, do you know what I mean? Like, this is 2001 and they're still using kind of, like, I do respect the film for the fact that, like, and it's the way I don't respect, like, a lot of modern stuff. Like, you watch, like, Stranger Things, for instance, and it's like, these kids don't talk like it's the 1980s. Otherwise, we'd be hearing homophobic slurs, we'd be hearing, like, all kinds of slurs, and everyone would be smoking. Whereas in this, we do get, like, that portrayal of how they would have spoke. The only thing is, when they say it, they're kind of saying it, like, with the audience being like, yeah, you like this word too. You like this kind of, like, do you know what I mean? Shortened down, version of Japanese, like, slur.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we're all in on this together. And it's kind of like, oh, no, how you should be portraying this is, like, America were a little fucked up too. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we weren't great, like, but we're just like, they're kind of like being like, that's cool, isn't it, guys? Isn't it? Like, it's kind of like, I guess through 2023 eyes, you kind of look at it going, it's not really cool. It's not really cool, but, like, yeah, the way you're doing it. But I do appreciate the kind of, I don't know, using the kind of what would have probably been said at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that's always such a difficult thing to kind of go down, right? Like, it's is good in the way that kind of you were saying, to have that kind of real portrayal of how they were talking, but then also like, is that still needed now? Because I don't know, like you can kind of imagine, because it was a 12 year olds and like a little bit younger going to watch it and being like, oh, maybe I want to play Pearl Harbor, and maybe that will be an okay thing for me to say, because exactly. This movie that I watched, they say it all the time. And there's not even anyone saying like, you know, oh, maybe you shouldn't say that. Because I presume that probably happened in the 40s. Like, you know, I don't know. I don't believe that everyone was throwing around racial slurs and everyone being like, that's an okay thing to say.
And I think it's the choice as well, because I imagine there would have been people referring to Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character by some unfavorable terms, yet they leave that out, because that's sort of like, even by 2001 standards, that is kind of not acceptable in a 12 rated film, whereas like, do you know what I mean? A Japanese racial slur is, and it's kind of like, it does give license to, as you say, like young teenage kids to be, it's not great.
No. So it's always like a difficult tangent to kind of, which way do you go? Do you go the way where like, this is actually what was said, or do you just say like, just not say it at all? Because it doesn't have any, I don't think it has any, like more effect to the movie for them to say these racial slurs. Like it would be fine if they didn't. And it's not, you know, it's not fine that they do, but you know, I understand why they were saying it, to kind of show off the times. So it's like, yeah, is there actually any need for it?
Mm-hmm. What other kind of factual inaccuracies did you find when kind of researching, or was that at the kind of bombing of the hospitals?
That was the only one that I knew about. And I did do like Pearl Harbor at school, and I've forgotten about everything about it. So I can't really do a compare from my knowledge. But
well, one of the things that I had to instantly Google when watching the film was, did Roosevelt stand up to prove a point? Yeah. Because I was very, and what I loved about this is that I only had to type in part of that, because a lot of people have asked that question. So I kind of felt vindicated in the fact that I'm not the only one who's like, oh, to prove a point, to be like, standing up, and I'm standing as we do this, to just say, don't tell me it's impossible. Like, as he stands, a man who is wheelchair bound, I was like, This has got to be Michael Bay. And yeah, it's Michael Bay. It's not, Roosevelt never stood up. I think the speech he delivers is like a famous speech that he gave, the Day of Infirmary speech that we see before we kind of go to the war room, and they're kind of like, what's the next move? And I'm really ignorant to this, and I didn't kind of look beforehand. And I was like, part of my head was like, is the retaliation to this Hiroshima? I was like,
that's what I thought.
I was waiting for Alec Baldwin's character to be like, you're getting on this plane, it's called Enola Gay. And it's like, oh no, like, no, Danny, no. Like,
No, that is 100% what I was expecting as well. I am glad that they didn't. And I can't remember when.
I've heard it lately.
But going back to the standing up of Roosevelt, it did just make me think of Willy Wonka when they like Grandpa Joe's getting out of bed. I was just being like, I've got a corner ticket.
Oh, I love it. They have his little coke nail, the fucking sponge, old Grandpa Joe. Oh. Yeah. I love it. What I always love about that film is like, looking back, and obviously the time like, made in the 70s, like, oh no, Grandpa, you need your smoking tobacco. And it's like, what a dirty prick. He's smoking ciggies in a bed with three other people. Have some respect, Grandpa Joe.
Oh, the 70s.
You dirty bastard. So Yeah, Roosevelt did not stand up. What I did love as a kind of small thing that Roosevelt had, I'm not sure if you picked up on this. The camera does linger on it. Is a pin cushion he has on his desk. Did you pick up on this?
You didn't pick up on that, no.
It is a pin cushion of Hitler bent over with pins pointed at his ass. And I was like,
how did I not notice this?
That's amazing. I was like, oh, wow. I was like, you reckon, I don't think you could get one of those now without like with it out like saying like you're maybe in favor of Hitler. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
feels like 1941. Yeah. It was like kind of like fuck this guy, and like kind of think about the logistics as well of like how you, I don't know, was that custom made? Was that?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Was there a factory like making this?
Yeah.
Like,
and was that a historical accuracy? Did Roosevelt actually have that? Did you Google?
No, I didn't get. Yeah, Roosevelt. Did Roosevelt have a Hitler pincushion? Ladies and gentlemen, you are getting some live Googling right now. Hitler pincushion. Here we go. It doesn't. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I think he did.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
Wow.
I think he actually did.
That is so funny. Wow.
Well, yeah, it does exist. There are like.
Wow.
So as you are listening to this podcast, hit up all the socials, which are at Caged In Pod, and you will see a picture of a Hitler pincushion put underneath the tweet. Or if you're on Instagram, you can scroll across and you can see a Hitler pincushion. I'm not going to put it as like the main picture on Instagram because that would probably fuck up my algorithm and like maybe get me taken down. But like, it's definitely going out there. Maybe I have to put a sensitivity warning. I don't know how things work anymore. No one sees my shit on Twitter anyway, so who fucking knows?
Thanks, Elon.
What other points of this film would you like? Do you think we need to talk about? Obviously, like casting wise, like what did you think of kind of some of the casting? I mean, did they get it right?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine casting. Like, I can't like think that anyone else would have done anything better. I can't think that anyone else would have done any worse. It's, you know, they got two heartthrobs from, you know, the late 90s, early noughties to get some bums on seats. They've got some girlfriends to go and see it with. And, you know, you've got some good-looking women to get the men in as well. So I think they've done fine with that. I don't think that anyone did a particularly amazing performance, apart from my lovely Betty in Red, mm-hmm. who I will stand by forever. But I mean, yeah, it's just a very kind of stereotypical casting of that time, really. Mm-hmm.
I think the people who like stood out to me, I know obviously he is he's not having the best of times lately, but Alec Baldwin is doing like the best Alec Baldwin. Like, he kind of has this knack of coming into films and like just monologuing at people. I was just instantly reminded of Glengarry Glen Ross with his like coffees for closers speech.
Yeah.
Like when he's like, when he's kind of like going on at them and he's like, listen to this phrase, gentlemen. He's like, and he kind of like says something in Chinese. He's like, that means I'm an American in Chinese.
Oh my God,
that's what you're going to need to know. And it's like, because you're not flying back to the US, you're flying to China. And he's like, he just has these moments. I was like, I thought when we got the first one, obviously, where he's like, you're a couple of hot shots up there. What the hell do you think you're doing in those planes? I was like, is this all we're going to get of Alec Baldwin? I'd be happy with that. But then when he came back, like, yeah, despite obviously killing someone, I was pleased to see him in this film. I don't know what that says about me, like, but just
no, like Alec Baldwin in the last kind of hour 50 minutes, it's just he's just got these weird one-liners. Like, it feels like it's a completely different movie, yeah, the last kind of hour. Like, it's these weird comical one-liners that Alec Baldwin just throws out randomly, and it's like, what is going on here? Like, I think he did stand out quite a bit for me as well, actually. I think I kind of blocked him from my mind a little bit. But like, looking back now, it's like, and you know, Dan Aykroyd's in it as well, yeah, randomly. I'm like, what the heck?
Dan Aykroyd.
Whenever we see Dan Aykroyd, me and my partner, in any movies, we always quote like a kind of obscure Space Jam quote, and just being like, I didn't know Dan Aykroyd was in this picture. <It's> like, constantly. and that was kind of a reaction from, like, a genuine reaction as well. I didn't realize Dan Aykroyd was in this. What's going on?
Yeah, playing some kind of he intercepts like spy shit, doesn't he? Like, kind of spy coding and stuff like that. He's kind of like listening in, like, yeah, working for the CIA or something. Yeah, he was like a surprise. I think, like, Tom Sizemore, like, I didn't know he was in it, so it was a surprise. But at the same time, because of the type of film it is, I wasn't surprised. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely.
Oh, it's Tom Sizemore. Yeah. He's another piece of shit. Of course he's going to be in this film. Like,
Michael Bay's got his checklist. Who can I have on? He's a piece of shit.
A lot of them future pieces of shit, right? Like, so yeah, it's that thing of like, it's like, no, he's like, just smell them out. Like, yeah, you're going to turn out to be a bad egg. Come on, boy.
Have you on. Yeah, you're like, my kind of person.
I thought Michael Shannon as well, I thought was like pretty great. Like, it's always great to see an actor who has gone on to be like massive, kind of, in something like a bit smaller. I think Kate Beckinsale like does the best of what she's got, right? Because I think she's got quite a thankless task with the character of Evelyn, because she's kind of a bit like, she is like the ultimate anti Bechdel test character, right? Like, she's totally like, all she does is serve her male counterparts in the film.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, she's not an amazingly well-written female character. I don't think there's really any in this movie particularly. All just care about the men that they're surrounded by. But, you know, yeah, she did the best with the hand that she was dealt with, really. So, no Liv Tyler, but she's all right.
I think the film in my imagination with Liv Tyler there, because I don't know, I think Liv Tyler just has a natural like bolshiness to her. I'm not sure if it's the fact that like a dad's the lead singer of Aerosmith, so she's like, fuck yeah, I'll fucking take on anyone. And I always think, like, I don't know if she was in this, maybe we would have got an absolute Aerosmith banger. Like, I don't want to miss a thing.
Definitely. Or there isn't a song to go along with Pearl Harbor, is there?
Yeah, they would have just been like, fuck it, we're needle dropping that again. It worked in that movie, it'll work in this too.
Yeah. And this was like the round about the time as well where like every other movie seemed to have like a song that went along with the movie, right? Like,
yes,
you know, it was a perfect timing during like our childhoods where there'd be like a rap at the end of the movie or a rock song, and it would be kind of related to the film, or it'd be literally them just singing the plot. And it's a shame we didn't have this for Pearl Harbor, like, well, some kind of romantic ballad.
it was nominated for Best Original Song for the song There You'll Be, which I imagine is probably over the credits, but like, I'm not sure about you, but as soon as like it went to black at the end, I was like, boom, see you later.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah, I've had 3 hours.
I was like,
of
it's
this.
Gone midnight. Like, I'm going to bed. Yeah. Like, I'm not watching the credits.
A film by Michael Bay. That's all I need to know. I maybe heard like the couple of first piano chords and went, yep, see ya, Diane. Yeah, sorry.
Definitely.
Sorry, Diane Warren.
Well, I'm sorry if there's any fans of the original song out there that are like fuming at me right now for being like, there wasn't a song to go along with this movie. I apologize.
Well, there is a song that came out off the back of this movie. I'm not sure if you've ever seen Team America World Police, but that has a song in it called The End of an Act, which the chorus for that song is Pearl Harbor sucked, but I still miss you. And basically kind of points out all of the flaws within this film, which is an absolute
I haven't seen Team America in so long, so I'm due a rewatch, definitely.
So some of the lines from one of the verses is, I need you like Ben Affleck needs acting school. He was terrible in that film. I need you like Cuba Gooding needed a bigger part. He's way better than Ben Affleck. Now all I can think about is your smile and that shitty movie too, Pearl Harbor sucked, and I miss you.
I mean, that just sums it up perfectly.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe this episode should have just been like me getting a strike, do you know what I mean, of just releasing that song as the as the episode.
That should have been my synopsis.
Just, just the really worthy, heartfelt reading of those lyrics, really posed, straight face. We were just discussing, obviously, the Best Original Song nomination. This film was also nominated for Best Sound Editing, and Best Visual Effects. It actually won Best Sound Editing. Do you think that's like a worthy win for this film? What did you think?
I mean, I guess it kind of depends what it was up against, really, during that time. But, you know, there was some good explosion noises. They do that well. But, sure, why not? Yeah, it was great. Why not?
Well, I watched this film on headphones, and I did like, during that battle sequence. And I think it is the thing with the Academy Awards is, I don't think they know what to do with, like, because this was when it was Best Sound Editing and Best Sound. Obviously, I think now they've kind of like rolled them together. And I don't think they fucking know what they're actually voting on there. They just kind of just go a sound, I don't know, like that had music in it. It's like, well, it's not fucking music, is it? Like, it's not, that's not what it's about. Like, so yeah, this was up against one other film. So very weird that it was this or Monsters, Inc.
So right. I guess okay. So, like, sure. I mean, yeah, fine. Pearl Harbor can have this, and I'm sure Monsters, Inc. won a way more deserving reward than sound editing. So.
Yeah. I think that the early 2000s were an interesting time for kind of like war films. Like, what's your kind of like feelings towards war films in general, Alice?
I enjoy a war film. Like, I've seen quite a few, and you know, they're always, I mean, it's changing a bit now, but back then and up until fairly recently, really, it's always like either the English or the Americans are the good guys and they did no wrong. And, you know, the baddies are, you know, the Germans or the Russians or whatever. And there's never a kind of counter side to it. And it's really nice to see now there is a kind of a different storytelling of war movies. Like, All Quiet on the Western Front was incredible. It's a side of, well, particularly for me anyway, a side of it's World War One, isn't it? World War One that we haven't seen before. It's a story that we haven't been told through a kind of a German perspective. I mean, they're fine. They're not ones that I would always go to, like, oh, I really want to watch a war film.
Yeah.
Right now.
It's like, so many people always say to me, like, you need to watch Come and See. And I'm like, I'm sure I do. But it very much feels like eating like 10 plates full of vegetables for me. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, harrowing and like really important cinema. But at the same time, it's like, I don't, like, people often say about that film, like, it's the closest representation what it would like to be in war. And it's like, I'm gonna use my privilege right here. I don't want to know what that feels like at times. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, my mental health's not the best, so I'm looking for escapism. I'm looking for 80s sleaze. Like, I'm looking for Brian De Palma movies. Like, not looking.
Definitely. I think the ones that I enjoyed the most is probably like the Vietnam War based ones, because there's no way that America can look good in those because, you know, they fucked up massively and they were the ones that were in the wrong. And it's a war that, you know, they failed at. And so it's always a more of an interesting kind of perspective, I think. And I find those ones a lot more interesting than the kind of World War ones.
Yes.
Because...
There's lots of films made by kind of pacifist directors in an interesting time in American cinema as well, with like Vietnam movies, where it's like your Apocalypse Nows and your kind of Platoons, where it's like you got Oliver Stone, who was there and knows how fucked up it was, or it's people who are like looking in on it and going like, we fucking sucked. Do you know what I mean? You got like Full Metal Jacket that kind of like felt like the kind of death nail of those films. Do you know what I mean? Like in that kind of big stretch through the 70s and 80s. And it's like, it is great to kind of be like a perspective from a countryman of that country, kind of shining a light on their own country and be like, we don't fucked up. Do you know what I mean? Like,
definitely.
Yeah. I think there's only, I've got only so much appetite for films where it's like, great, do you know what I mean? Like this film, like a kind of soaring Hans Zimmer score that like every moment is kind of telling you how to feel. Like, how do you... Were you manipulated by Hans Zimmer in this film, Alice?
I mean, it's hard not to be manipulated by Hans Zimmer, isn't it? Like, he knows how to get you. I mean, like, I probably not really. Like, I mean, the whole Pearl Harbor bit was, I think it was just over too quickly for me to get any kind of like emotional attachment to what was kind of happening. It all felt very quick. And even when you were seeing people, like, there were some moments where people were drowning and stuck in the vessels, and you were a little bit like, oh, that's sad. And it's like, oh, quickly, let's just see what Josh Hartnett's doing now. And you're like, oh, okay. So I think you just weren't given enough time to get emotionally involved with the whole like Pearl Harbor bit, really.
Yeah.
And it was just, you would just get forced to be emotionally involved in this stupid relationship. Like,
who in this film do you wish, like, I don't know, you could have like gotten invested in? Because I found myself with the journalist who's filming, like when Pearl Harbor's happening, I was like, oh, like, if I see anyone in this film that is me, it's that idiot. Do you know what I mean? It's like, like nowadays some shit's kicking off. They're like, oh, I got my little portable recorder. Like, let's get in on this. Like this is going on. Like, I'd be the podcasting equivalent of that guy.
Like, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I felt sorry for him. But again, it didn't feel like we had like enough time with him. It was kind of, we see him occasionally film things, and then it was like, oh, now he's dead. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, I wanted like maybe a little bit more with him to kind of get that kind of emotional connection and feel kind of sad if he died.
Okay. So yeah, we've kind of been, I don't know, I'd say middling on this film. What are some of the moments before we start to wrap up that you enjoyed about this film? What are the things that you really liked? If any.
I mean, the action sequences were good, and I did quite enjoy the first when Rafe is in England and he's fighting the Jets, and that whole moment was pretty good. And it was quite tense when, you know, when he falls into the water and you're like, this is horrific, I can't imagine this happening to me. Like, this just must be a horrible thing to just be like, well, I'm gonna die. This is it. I think that was a kind of a standout moment for me. Maybe that was when I kind of got a little bit emotionally invested. But I mean, it's just a fine movie. It's difficult to kind of like pick anything out that was like, oh, this bit was really, really good. Cause it's just like the whole way through, you're just like, this is Michael Bay movie. So okay. Like
more than anything of like going like, that's visually interesting. And I guess some of this would come down to John Schwartzman as well. Cause up until this point was kind of like, and I guess whichever way you fall down on it, like, is either to thank or to blame for the Michael Bay style, because he was the cinematographer on The Rock, Armageddon, and Pearl Harbor. So, like, he had a kind of hand in that visual style. But there are shots in this, and I found myself watching it instead of going, they are obviously technically amazing shots, but they are also, like, it's a Michael Bay shot right now, and like, or like kind of like shots he loves to go back to, and you get them in Armageddon, you get them in this. It's like the ordinary people as shit's about to go down. Do you know what I mean? Like in this, you kind of get like kids playing in like baseball and they're like looking up into the sky, or you get like little girls with fairy wings and stuff like that. It's, like, it's all this kind of like Huey lens and stuff like that, and it is all old school Americana and like blowing, do you know what I mean, it's cornfields blowing in the wind, and there's lots of uses of yellow in this film. There's just kind of
so like much yellow and like lots of low shots as well, like looking up, like that's again in like, it's in Bad Boys, it's in Armageddon, it's in like every all the Transformer movies, probably. Like.
Yeah, not normally in Transformer movies, it's a low shot looking up someone's asshole, essentially. A female character's like, oh, fucking hell. I don't need to see Megan Fox's asshole. Thank you, Michael. But and I think there's even a use of when Rafe is waiting for Evelyn to like finish at the hospital when he goes with the bottle of champagne. There's like a Dutch angle shot of like a low Dutch angle shot of the stairs. I'm like, what the fuck was that? What the fuck were you guys thinking? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I can imagine John Schwartzman, they'd be like, are you sure, Michael? I could tilt that camera, boy. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, over the shoulder. Like, and I don't, I've heard stories of Michael Bay that apparently, if you're not doing what he wants to do with the camera, he is the type of guy. One, because he knows how to do it, and two, because he is this asshole will just kind of like push you out of the way and be like, I'll fucking film it then if you're not gonna do it.
That does not surprise me at all.
I love to think that he was the one flying the drones for ambulance as well. Like, no, this is how I want the drone to go. I want it to go up this building, up Jake Gyllenhaal's ass. Like, oh, fucking hell. Amazing. Well, yeah, is there any other points that we've missed that you feel like need to be talked about with this film, Alice?
I don't think so. I think that even though it's 3 hours long, there's not a whole lot of substance to this movie. No. So I think we've got it all, really, haven't we?
Yeah. I think what one other thing I liked is you could look at this as like Top Gun year one, especially when we get to that sequence where they're stripping out the planes and they're going like, this is going to be the first time a plane has ever taken off from like one of the naval ships. And I was like, oh, you get all of that shit in like the Top Gun movies. And like in Top Gun Maverick, you get like the landing on like one of the naval ships. And you see that kind of like rubber band like thing they have to catch the planes. And I was like, yeah, this is like Top Gun, like, do you know what I mean? And it's like two separate fucking movies. Like, that is the thing. This is two films. This is two films sandwiched together to like that. I guess eventually is lesser than the sum of its parts, right? In that it falls short on the romance stuff because it wants to do the action stuff. It falls short on the action stuff because it wants to do the romance stuff. So like, I think he wants to have his cake and eat it, and at the end of the day, we end up with shit on our faces. Like, from one of those low camera angles up someone's ass. Amazing. So one of the things we like to do on this podcast as we wrap things up is look for Coppola connections within the film. So is there anyone in front of or behind the camera who has worked with the Coppolas elsewhere in their filmography? Could you find any, Alice?
I mean, is quite an obvious one that I thought of, but Josh Hartnett's in Virgin Suicides.
Oh, Trip Fontaine. Oh, he has my heart.
There we go. And I didn't find any others. Well, I didn't look up for any others. I was like, I know that one. There you go. That's the answer to that.
I will rattle off a few that, like, I don't know. I sometimes find that, like, having this section a thankless task for myself, because it, normally it means just scrolling through people's IMDBs endlessly. And yeah. It's not a lot of fun, and I imagine not a lot of fun for the listeners, but these are the ones that came to me just off the top of my head. So Ben Affleck is Armageddon, which John Swartzman was the cinematographer on. John Voight is in The Rainmaker, which is directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And National Treasure and National Treasure Book of Secrets, which Nicolas Cage is in. And he's also going to be in Francis Ford Coppola's Megaropolis, which is currently wrapped filming. So it's going to be his next potentially final film. William Lee Thomas, who plays one of the army cadets, is in Gone in 60 Seconds with Nicolas Cage. And Tom Sizemore is in Bringing Out the Dead, which is, Nicolas Cage starring film directed by Martin Scorsese. And a very tenuous one. Lily Sheen is the daughter of Kate Beckinsale and plays Nicolas Cage's daughter in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. And if you've seen that film, she looks the spitting image of her mum.
Well, I loved that film so much. It was so good.
Amazing, amazing. So the way we rate films on this podcast, Alice, is we ask, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film? The Coppolas love their wines. Francis just sold a bloody vineyard to fund his next movie. What wine would you pair with Pearl Harbor?
So it's got to be something that's easy to drink, not too complicated in its flavor. Mm-hmm. Probably something that will give you a horrible hangover after just having like one glass or something. So it's going to be like an Echo Falls or something like that. Like it's got to be something cheap, but everyone kind of likes.
Yeah, a little something for the mummies. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Yeah,
wine mums. Yeah. We're talking live, laugh, love mums. Like, you know?
Yeah, definitely. One for the Huns, 100%.
Yes, please, like, yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, I think the obvious pick with this is something like a Lambrini, but I think you've nailed it with the kind of, like, the go-to kind of, like, supermarket, like, always on offer, always kind of, I don't know, it's a bastardized grape, like, doesn't it? Who fucking knows where it's from? It's a bit of Australia, it's a bit of Italy. We're throwing a bit of whatever we can get here. Yeah, I think Echo Falls like is a great brand to throw out. And I don't know. I think I'm gonna go for a rosé just because there's a little bit of blood in this film, but it's got
it's more
focused on the sweetness than it is on the kind of the darkness of the film. So
yeah, I was thinking of a rosé as I was thinking up of what wine to pair with it. So yeah, definitely a rosé.
Yeah, because I think a lot of, like, especially those bog standard like supermarket rosés, then they're not really one or the other like this film, really. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of like it's weirdly sickly sweet, and it hasn't got the darkness of like, what you're almost drinking it going, what is this? Is this like diluted squash? Like, is this like undiluted squash? Yeah. Like,
The kind of the summer fruits Echo Falls, I think, is that is it. That is this movie.
Amazing. I really nearly stepped over this next question, why I kind of stumbled as I was explaining the wine. But is this a top shelf, middle shelf, or bottom shelf wine? AKA, is the film any good?
It's a bottom shelf wine, isn't it? Like, it's I can't say that it's an Echo Falls and then go, it's a top shelf wine. That would say something about me, wouldn't it? But yeah, it's a bottom shelf for me, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's like the top of the bottom shelf. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not bending over for this. but you're also like, yeah, you can, and it's maybe on a yellow sticker.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
You're not dusting anything off or anything like that. Like, oh,
if this is a restaurant wine, you're not turning over the page on the menu. Do you know what I mean? Your front page, your house wine in it.
Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. So based on Pearl Harbor alone and Robert and John Schwartzman's contributions to this film, are they the greatest film family of all time, Alice?
Well, unfortunately, not based on Pearl Harbor.
I feel like that question is evil, but I love asking.
I can't say they are. If it was based on this film solely, as the rules are, no.
What do you think of his work, though, in this film? Do you think he, like... Is it good? It's serviceable, right? I think that is.
Yeah, he does the job for what's needed for the movie, right? It's fine. He does the job well. He gets those low shots in. He makes sure that we can see those sparks.
I guess that's the job of a DOP, like, somewhat, is to just service the vision of the director, right? Like, there's not that many rock star DOPs. Like, I guess most people, all they think of is like Roger Deakins, but then he's just so good because he does manage to just service the directors and kind of make them a bit better. Whereas,
so,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Schwartzman, very much the kind of, I don't know, journeyman cinematographer, just kind of, yeah, really fits the brief of what people want, and yeah, it's, I'll knock him for that. He's got good CV.
He knows how to make his summer blockbusters, and you know, fair enough. Like,
and he also knows how to make his knows how to make his John Lee Hancock films as well. He's all over the place. He's got an interesting he's got an interesting CV. So let me ask you two more questions before I let you go, Alice. Okay. The first one being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the collective filmographies of the rest of the family?
I'm going to have to go with my gal Sofia Coppola, really.
Yes, please. Yeah, I guess this hasn't really been talked about on the podcast. Maybe only briefly when we recently talked about her daughter's viral TikTok and the fact that she's making a Priscilla Presley movie. Is this something that you're excited for? Like, do you know anything about this film? Or like...
I don't know anything about it, actually, but I think it'd be an interesting one to kind of hear about. Like, I haven't watched the Elvis movie yet, so maybe I'll just skip that and go straight on to Priscilla. But I think that she would do a really good job at it. And you know, like, I have a tough relationship with Francis Ford Coppola because he does drag out his movies, and I do struggle with long old movies. So I think he's been put in my bad books since having to write an essay on The Conversation. So I think I'm triggered by him now. I'm like, no, not that.
I like that you've held this hot take for the end. Like, I like it. I know. Don't worry, this isn't me. Were you scared that I'd like boot you off the podcast? I'm all here for Francis Ford Coppola slander. I'm a biased, impartial voice. If that makes any sense whatsoever.
I mean, I think I'm kind of like, I'm biased as well. I'm not like 100% against him, but I think that like Sofia Coppola has done movies that I would turn to a little bit more rather than Francis.
Sofia's got such a great track record of films and kind of has such a, I don't know, unique voice and managed to capture some great things in her films. And all of them are just massively kind of, I don't know, feminine focused and kind of manages to like shine a light and make films that up and, I don't know, like a lot of the times don't get made about women in that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're kind of like serious films. Like, do you know what I mean? Virgin Suicide's a perfect example, a film that kind of like, up until that point, it's like, I don't know, you got a lot of those serious teen films for boys. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola did it with The Outsiders, and then she kind of was like, why is nobody making this for teenage girls? We're not all just like, we don't just want rom-coms and kind of like fluffy eye candy. We want a little bit of that. That's why we'll give you Trip Fontaine, but we also want to talk about depression in teens.
Definitely, yeah. And so I think that's why also, you know, I'm quite intrigued with Priscilla Presley movie. I think that, you know, she could do a good job of it and have a really interesting take on it.
Amazing. And it's amazing that Sophia is your choice, because it leads me perfectly onto my final question, and arguably the most important question of this podcast, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
See, I haven't seen Lost Translation in such a long time. So I had to like really like dig deep in my memory for this particular scene. And I just had to come up with something that is probably not very profound at all. And just because I had Pearl Harbor on the mind, and I just said that Betty shouldn't have died.
Perfect.
I'm so caught up about Betty.
Perfect. I love it. Yeah. But like, justice for hashtag justice for Betty.
Exactly. Yeah.
Betty and Red forever. I will find my nearest oak tree and carve it.
Yeah.
Carve it upon the bark.
It's going to be my next tattoo.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, like an old school sailor tat. Really, really keeping vibes with the film. I love it.
Exactly,
Well, where's the best place for people to keep up to date with yourself and everything you're doing at Drunken Horror?
So you can find me on Twitter at A Boyd Leslie. You can find Drunken Horror on Twitter and Instagram at Drunken Horror. And that's where we'll keep you all updated. We've got some fun things coming up. We've got, we've just released a line of merch, and we've got a Patreon coming very soon. We've got some fun guests coming up to chat about movies. We're doing a whole wide range of different kinds of horror movies. Yeah. We're going musicals, we're going gateway horror, and we're going to torture porn. So we're going all around
I love it.
The horror world. So catch us there.
Yeah, I've been listening to your podcast for a while, and I really do love the kind of dynamic the three of you have. It kind of like it's really great. I think that's what a lot of people go for podcasts for, right? They're kind of like, the subject matter is the entry point, and then it's like, you kind of you're like the fourth or fifth sometimes in a conversation where you get to be passive and kind of sit there and maybe to yourself be like, I'd love to say this, or like, I hope they mention this little nerdy fact I know about this movie.
Yeah.
I really get that listening to your pod.
That's amazing, because that's exactly the kind of vibes that we want to have. We want it to feel like you're just sitting with us having a conversation. So it's good to hear.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been amazing.
Again, a massive thank you to Alice for joining me for this conversation. It was tons of fun, and I'm sure you will agree. A massive thank you to you as well for listening. It's always an absolute delight. You stick around for the end. You listen to the whole thing. If you listen to the whole thing, thank you even more so. You're the real ones. You're the ultras, the killers, the absolute dog darn dastardly bad men. I love you all women or non-binary, whoever you are. I love you irregardless. And I'll love you irregardless if you have a differing opinion of this film. This is your favourite film, and you feel that me and Alice gave it a bit of short shrift, then don't hesitate to get in touch, and you can do so at Caged In Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your opinions on films. I'd love to hear what you'd like me to cover. Recently on Twitter, somebody said, hey, Sofia Coppola's daughter had a viral TikTok. This surely needs to be covered on your podcast. And you know what? I roped in my good old friend Claire Ellen Hope, and we covered it. You can listen to that. That will be the last thing on your feed from last Thursday at time of release. So yeah, just the next episode down, listen to that. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm happy to go down these weird tangents and areas that people want me to go down. I want to be the kind of all-encompassing Coppola fountain of knowledge podcast that you just cannot escape. If you want to know anything about the Coppola family, this should be your one-stop shop. Not only did we talk about that viral tweet in that episode, we also talked about the trailer for Wes Anderson's new film Asteroid City, which is very exciting for me because it looks like our boy Jason Schwartzman is the lead in that movie, or if not a significant part of it, which is very differing from his last outing with Wes Anderson in The French Dispatch, where he had a cameo role at best. As for next week on the pod, guys, I've got a great episode planned for you. Should I tell you what the film is? Should I not? I'll tell you what it is. It's Stigmata. I've got a fantastic guest lined up for it that you'll hear all about next week. But yeah, we're doing a very Eastery special with Stigmata, the 1999, I believe, Patricia Arquette movie. So watch that in the next week. Get ready for it. And then after that, we're going some fun territory with the podcast for a couple of weeks. So yeah, keep your ears open for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. And if you'd like to support this dear old podcast, you can do so by heading on to patreon.com/CagedInPod, where you can give us a little bit of cash and it will make me very grateful, and you get some fun stuff in return. Very soon you'll be able to hear a regular series between myself, Will Chich, a regular kind of contributor to the podcast, where we will be talking about the films produced by Albert S. Ruddy in a series we're calling Ruddy Hell, which will be a lot of fun and tangentially linked to the Coppola family because he was one of the key producers on The Godfather and has a kind of fun and interesting career all by himself. So yeah, we thought we'd do that. We have some other fun stuff planned once that is done. Also, if you want to spend cash, get something in return, you can head on over to our TeePublic or Etsy store, where you can grab a lovely Caged In t-shirt. So up on Etsy at the moment, we have a couple of Mandy designs. Up on TeePublic, we have three Mandy-inspired designs and one Wicker Man-inspired design, the old t-shirt that would have been released like a year or so ago. So yeah, head on over to those and support the podcast in that way, and show people that you love the podcast by wearing it upon your chest or on a mug or whatever. And TeePublic offers a vast variety of things. The Etsy store is the perfect place for British listeners, especially because the shipping fees are far lower than they are with TeePublic. So head on over to there to get all of that good stuff. Or if you don't want to impart with any money whatsoever, you can support this podcast by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and give it a 5-star rating. And if you can leave a review, and I implore that you do, please let me know what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. So as ever, guys, I've been Petr Spatsilivis, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember, keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharle Cinecast Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.